In some hospitals, one in four patients faced delays of 12 hours or more. One 88-year-old woman was left waiting 16 hours, according to the Liberal Democrats. The analysis showed the actual amount of time patients spent in accidents and emergency departments after arriving before being admitted to hospital, transferred or discharged. The figures are separate from last week's published trolley wait figures, which only measure the time taken after a decision to admit a patient has been made. The number of people waiting more than 12 hours in accidents and emergency departments from a decision to admit them to actually being admitted to hospital soared to 54,308 in January, up sharply from 44,045 in December. This was the second highest figure on record, just below 54,573 in December of 2022. The number of people who waited at least 4 hours from the decision to admission also grew from 148,282 in December to 158,721 last month. Again, the second highest figure on record. Long waits at accidents and emergency departments have been linked to serious patient harm. The Royal College of Emergency Medicine has previously highlighted data showing that once people wait more than about 6 hours and need to be admitted into hospital, their risk of dying starts to increase. Daisy Cooper said, "Waits of 12 hours or more can have catastrophic consequences for people's health, particularly the elderly and vulnerable people. No one should have to wait this long for care, yet in some areas, this unacceptably long delays have become almost the norm. It's time Conservative ministers started taking this National Health Service crisis seriously, instead of ignoring all the warning signs while patients are suffering." The Department of Health and Social Care said accidents and emergency performance was improving despite winter pressures and the highest number of January accidents and emergency attendances on record. "We're determined to continue improving patient care, having already delivered on our promise to create 5,000 extra permanent hospital beds and 10,000 hospital at home beds, freeing up capacity and cutting waiting times," according to a spokesperson. British newspaper The Nottingham Post has also covered this story. More than 1,000 people were stuck waiting for over 12 hours in accidents and emergency departments in Nottinghamshire last month. The latest data from the National Health Service has shown a dramatic increase in patients experiencing a 12-hour wait to be admitted to accidents and emergency departments in January over the last 8 years. A total of 900 patients at Nottingham University Hospital's NHS Trust and 224 patients at Sherwood Forest Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust had a 12-hour wait to be admitted to accidents and emergency in January, according to the latest data from the National Health Service. That's up from 855 last January at Nottingham University Hospital's and 289 at Sherwood Forest Hospitals. In January of 2022, there were 514 and 40 at the two respective hospitals who had to wait over 12 hours to be admitted. Back in January of 2019, there were none at either NHS Trust, nor in January of 2018, while in 2017, there were just two patients at Nottingham University Hospitals. Nationally, a total of 54,308 patients had a 12-hour wait to be admitted to accidents and emergency this January. This is the second highest number on record, behind only December of 2022, when 54,573 people had to wait over 12 hours. The Liberal Democrat website has also covered this story and tells us more. A staggering 1.5 million patients in England waited 12 hours or more after arriving at accidents and emergency departments over the past year, new analysis by the Liberal Democrats has revealed. The figures reveal the true scale of the accidents and emergency delays over a 12-month period for the first time. Shockingly, at some NHS trusts, over 1 in 4 patients are facing delays of 12 hours or more after arriving at accidents and emergency departments. The Liberal Democrat said it showed that 12-hour delays had become almost the norm in some areas of England. The previously hidden data from NHS England shows the actual amount of time patients spent in accidents and emergency after arriving before being admitted to hospital, transferred or discharged. These figures are separate from the regularly published trolley wait figures, which only measure the time taken after a decision to admit a patient has been made. The latest figures show that in total, 1,540,945 patients faced waits of 12 hours or more after arriving at accidents and emergency between February of 2023, when the new data was first published, to January of 2024. This equates to almost 1 in 10 or 9.6% of patients during that period, 5 times higher than the National Health Service requirement that no more than 2% of patients should wait 12 hours or more. Shockingly, it means an average of over 4,200 patients waited over 12 hours at accidents and emergency departments every day over the past year. January saw the worst figures yet as winter pressure stuck, with a record 177,805 or 1 in 8 patients, that is 12.4%, facing accidents and emergency waits of over 12 hours. At Blackpool Teaching Hospitals, over 1 in 4 patients in January faced accidents and emergency delays of 12 hours or more, the worst in the country. This was followed by Shrewsbury and Telford Hospital with 25.4%. Research from the Royal College of Emergency Medicine has previously estimated that for every 82 admitted patients whose transfer to a hospital bed is delayed beyond 6 to 8 hours from arrival, there is one extra death. Liberal Democrat health spokesperson Daisy Cooper, MP, said, "These devastating delays lay bare the stark impact of this government's neglect of the National Health Service. Every day, thousands of patients are being left scared and in pain in overcrowded accidents and emergency departments waiting for 12 hours or more to receive the care that they need. Waits of 12 hours or more can have catastrophic consequences for people's health, particularly the elderly and the vulnerable. No one should have to wait this long for care, yet in some areas these unacceptably long delays have become almost the norm."
Muhammad Iqbal, also famously known as Allama Iqbal, was a famous poet, philosopher, lawyer, and politician. Muhammad Iqbal is called the spiritual father of Pakistan, as he is believed to be the inspiration behind the historical Pakistan movement, in which he was one of the few leaders who first conceived the idea of Pakistan as a different nation for the Muslims. Iqbal is Pakistan's national poet, and his birthday is a public holiday in Pakistan. Muhammad Iqbal, also known as Iqbal Lahori, is considered one of the most important figures in Urdu literature, with literary work in both the Urdu and Persian languages. Although Urdu poetry draws heavily on Persian idiom and imagery, Iqbal found Persian more suited to his thought and temperament, and a better means of communication to a wider audience in the Indian subcontinent as well as other countries of the Muslim world. At the end, more than half and nearly two-thirds of Iqbal's poetry was in Persian language. Stay with us as this week's program looks into this extraordinary man's life and legacy.
The fragrance of the companion shall take a nation to the companion. Sometimes childhood memories appear before my eyes like a pale pall of imagination. Among those rippling images there sails the craft of my thought towards the shore of silence, to anchor in the harbor of its own. I dwell on my existence. I want to decipher the oriental thoughts and secrets, and to put an end to my bewilderment and self-alienation. I am a traveler, standing on the shore of thoughts. My aim, to pinpoint my lost identity. I am a traveler, walking on the road of human thoughts. My destination is the land of belief in oneself, in a bid to revive an identity which might no longer exist. It is an identity which, like a child's toy, is played with, but in a deadly way.
Some ignorant guys sent to the slaughterhouse of death every day thousands of innocent people because they are deeply buried in the marsh of their jejune ideas. In a way, there are two types of travels, a physical one, or going from one place to another, and a spiritual one, or transforming from one mood to another. Those embarking on the first type are many in number, and those embarking on the second type are much less. My travel is a mixture of both. Within the land and the sky, a travel in time to appreciate the ideas of an Eastern philosopher, namely Allama Muhammad Iqbal, the thinker, that if his thoughts were well understood, we would not witness the ignorant behaviors by Takfiri groups that are far from Islamic injunctions and humanity these days. Allama Iqbal wrote great mysteries in his books for his son, Javed Iqbal, and all others. As an old man, Javed knows it well whom his father was addressing. Javed talks to him like this.
Right now, I am 90 years old. You don't address people of my age. You address young people. You like them to believe what I say. I personally cannot fully understand you. I follow a path not wanted by you. Talk to me, who is 90 years old. You feel the elderly usually talk in a desperate way. You advise that one should not be desperate. The right man is hidden in you. Go on with your search. He will surely appear. You are saying the same thing. You have not visited me. I did my best. I searched for 90 years, but I did not find that right man. Where is he then? Tell me if you know.
I begin my journey right from here to the city of Sialkot, the birthplace of Iqbal. Perhaps in this travel, I would be able to show some special features of that righteous man. Today, Sialkot is a city in Punjab, Pakistan. The city, when Iqbal was born, was part of India.
Oh, you who are familiar with me, come with me to the childhood alleys. Tread on memory's pathway. Come with me to my intimate's alley. In my childhood home, on roofs quite stranger to all noises. May they be merrily remembered. The period of harmony with existence and excellence. The pleasant period of being with a companion, with all its liveliness. During all the year's generous moments, those alleys full of love, the splash of pure wafers.
ये वो घर है जहाँ अल्लामा इकबाल 9 November 1877 को सुबह 5
Here is the very room wherein Iqbal was born on the 9th of November 1877 at 5:14 a.m.
उन्होंने इस घर की इब्तिदा की 6 फरवरी 1861
The house here was built by his grandfather Sheikh Muhammad Rafiq. He was the first to occupy the house. On the 6th of February 1861, he bought 3 small rooms and a house near here until Iqbal was born. Later, Iqbal's elder brother came here. The house has undergone no change since then.
Iqbal's ancestors were high-ranking Brahmins of Kashmir. They converted to Islam 500 years before Iqbal was born. The family was called Separu, meaning educated. His father was a cloth dealer. Nur Muhammad's shop was frequented by great thinkers of Islamic sects. His mother, Imam Bibi, was also a religious woman. Iqbal had one brother and 4 sisters, all of them his senior.
Rooms were built before anything else in 1861. Iqbal's family prepared the first room for the wives. There, in that room, you see a cradle and a chair.
Encouraged by his father, Muhammad Iqbal learned the Quran from his very childhood in Hisamuddin Mosque of Kashmiris. Basic lessons were learned at home, as Iqbal says this was the best period of his lifetime, because under his father's support, his thinking foundations became established. Sialkot's graveyard tells years later, when his father died, the story of Iqbal's attachment.
So many times I've asked myself, what is existence? From where does it take root? What a secret it is that has attracted thinkers' attention. I could not find answers to those questions. Then, many years later, when my thoughts expanded, I traveled back to my childhood to find answers to my questions. There it was my father who decided on the shape a thing should take. Years later, when unknown things became clear to me, I came to understand Mir Hassan's teachings. He talked to me about the Book of Life, but he did not mention the book's title. A condition set before me by him was this: to learn new sciences, Europeans learn. It is only then that you come to know what the value of the Book of Life is. He was quite right. Years later, with all my heart, I came to fully know the Book of Life. The Book of Life, the Holy Quran, whose wisdom is eternal and solid. It is an illustration for life secrets. Its power makes the unfaithful faithful. To mankind, it is the only message. The bearer of it will enjoy the mercy of both worlds. Bandits turn into leaders just through its memorization. They become pious just with the help of this very book. He whose heart's pulsation is the result of the book's warmth, his restless way finds comfort just as does a pearl. Should you want to live a Muslim life, only through the Quran is this possible.
Sialkot, a city in northeastern Punjab province, located at the foot of the snow-clad Kashmiri Mountain. It was in this crowded city where Allama Iqbal's first educational basis took root. Having received his first training by father and such a great teacher as Molina Mir Hassan, the young Muhammad entered Scotch Mission School to start his official education therein. The school's premises, against passage of centuries, keeps the same shape as it used to have.
He finished his high school here in 1891. Then in 1893, he completed his 10th grade, and it was here where he finally ended his high school education in 1895 and got his high school diploma.
Having finished his high school in Sialkot, Muhammad Iqbal found the city too small to give him an opportunity to fly higher up in the sky. Muhammad was 18 when he finished his pre-university courses with honors, receiving 2 academic gold medals. Admitted on a scholarship, he left Sialkot for Lahore as advised by his teacher Mir Hassan. Lahore was a city southwest of his birthplace, 125 kilometers away from it. Then Muhammad Iqbal went to Punjab University, one of Pakistan's oldest universities, established in 1882 by the British ruler of the Indian subcontinent in Lahore. There, the instruction language was English, though some lessons were taught in Urdu. Young Iqbal of Sialkot went there to continue his education. Very soon, he got so famous throughout the world due to his thoughts and his Persian Urdu poems. Known as Iqbal Lahori, he was destined to get his BA and MA here and compose his earliest poems.
Allama Iqbal bila shuba hamari islami duniya ka.
Undoubtedly, Iqbal is, for us in the world of Islam, a clear metaphor and a great name. Iqbal found an Islamic world, a special thought. At the present time, we are living in a place so blessed as it witnessed Iqbal, the learned, for 5 years. At a time when Iqbal arrived here from Sialkot to enroll for BA, the state university here had this one dormitory only. Iqbal lived here for 5 years. I mean, his presence here lasted about 5 years. He then enrolled for MA in philosophy. He completed his MA.
Iqbal, as it seems to me, went through 2 periods in his life, a wisdom period and a love period.
During the time Iqbal was still in the subcontinent, and when he had not yet left for the West, he was naturally well acquainted with Western philosophy. had deeply studied Hinduism and Islamic thoughts.
At that time, Iqbal was quite familiar with Indian mysticism, and the traces of that school of thought can be found in his poems.
He studied in depth our religion. And with such a deep knowledge, he left for the West.
There was no ending to the stories of my restlessness and abandoning similar places. I was 28 when, recommended by my teacher, Sir Thomas Arnold, I left for Europe to continue my studies. Having a master's degree in philosophy, I had taught at the Oriental College, but going to England and starting study at Cambridge University for a doctorate in philosophy changed everything. Studying at Cambridge secured me opportunities to know better and more about Western philosophers. At the same time, I enrolled at the Faculty of Law to be able to get permission to act as attorney. The rest had no meaning to me. For that very year, I traveled to Hamburg, Germany, to do more research and finish my doctoral dissertation. For a whole year, I worked so hard to get fully familiar with philosophical foundations and to get my doctoral thesis finished. At that time, I made much of well-known philosophy teachers, such as the famous professor of philosophy, Mac Nicrad, and the famous Orientalist, Reinhold Elin Nicholson.
He continued his university studies in Heidelberg, Germany, and became familiar with the thoughts and ideas of such philosophers as Nietzsche, Fichte, Schopenhauer, and the like. There were similarities between his thoughts and the thoughts of those learned men.
Iqbal continues to say that he was changing and thinking those days.
Interestingly enough, Iqbal was influenced by Western philosophers. He adopted their thoughts and opinions. He received ideas from them, but mixed them with his own to create an independent thought system and called it own philosophy.
Having received his doctor of philosophy, Iqbal returned at the age of 31 to Lahore. Never did he hesitate to return home, contrary to some students of that time. He left England quickly. He was then licensed to practice attorneyship and became a member of Lahore Bar Association. 3 years later, he became a lecturer in philosophy at Lahore University. He resigned after a while to exclusively practice as an attorney. This way, he was able to freely publish his thoughts. He continuously thought about finding a way to awaken Muslims taken captive by colonialism.
All my life has been coincident with the Indian subcontinent's darkest days. British colonialism and now World War I. India was dominated by colonialism since the 18th century. But as World War I began in August 1914, a new form of cruelty began to cover my land. Indians went to fight a war wherein they had played no role. They were killed and killed for people who themselves were the main factor in bringing ruin and destruction to the whole world. Description of troubles brought about by those calamities is actually impossible.
روز زمانه میں جب 1910 and 1911, and after World War I, we see a number of liberation movements. Muslims rose against British and European colonizers. So Iqbal found himself on a well-defined route. He started composing revolutionary poems.
After World War I, in 1918, and the fall of the Ottoman Empire, something had to be done quickly to save people of the tyranny imposed on them. I knew that a worldwide caliphate was no longer practicable. There was no agreement between Islamic unity and blind religious prejudice or extreme nationalistic ideas as promulgated by colonial powers. Unwillingly, I engaged in political activities. I tried to raise public awareness to bring about self-reliance.
Allama ran for Punjab parliament election. As he said, he hated political activities and Muslims' needs forced him to enter the political arena. Consequently, he joined the Muslim League Party. He succeeded to become an MP for Punjab province for 3 years. During that time, he tried to solve Muslims' problems. Iqbal used to talk on such problems.
Allama Iqbal nurtured the wish for an independent Pakistan. He would say a new country, an Islamic country, would come into existence on the world map. The country's name, he would say, will be Pakistan. Iqbal did not give this name to a new country, but surely he had it as a Muslim country in mind.
During my lifetime, I liked those sleeping in the world of thought to wake up from their deep sleep. But sadly, the sleep is too deep. Therefore, I took refuge in the world of rhythmic words and meaningful poems to awaken the youths of this sorrowful nation in order to sail the craft of our thoughts to the shore of productivity. I was a young man when I found out that to weather horrible tempests and the enemy's lurking place, we had no way but recourse to the miracle of last time. The Holy Quran, the book with miraculous words, which can be used as the best means to awaken thought and exalt the belief in self. The book is most succoring, particularly to the youth. I, who despair of the sages of old, have a word to say touching the day to come. Render my speech easy unto the young. Make my abyss for them attainable.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The limelight.
According to the British Retail Consortium, shop thefts in England have more than doubled in the past 3 years, costing retailers some £953 million a year. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. UK shop workers are facing 1,300 incidents of violence and abuse a day and a battle to control brazen acts of shoplifting as pressure mounts on ministers to intervene to protect retail employees. According to the British Retail Consortium, the trade body which represents most major shops retailers in Britain, retailers saw the number of incidents of racial abuse, sexual harassment, physical assaults and threats with weapons rise 50% last year, while thefts more than doubled to 16.7 million incidents. The rise in retail crime has coincided with a period of rampant price inflation, with the cost of everyday goods from eggs to baby formula increasing over the past 2 years at a rate not seen since records began in the 1970s, leaving many families struggling to make ends meet. Some experts argue that efforts to cut labour costs by using technology such as self-checkouts have contributed to the problem, while retailers are blaming a rise in organised crime and scarce police resources. Helen Dickinson, the British Retail Consortium's chief executive, called for police to step up the number of arrests. Helen Dickinson said, despite retailers investing huge sums in crime prevention, violence and abuse against retail workers is climbing. Criminals are being given a free pass to steal goods and to abuse and assault retail colleagues. No one should have to go to work fearing for their safety. The number of thefts has quadrupled on a pre-pandemic levels. Violence and abuse, which fell after a spike during the lockdowns of 2020, have jumped back up and are now three times higher than before the pandemic. The latest figures come after almost 90 retail leaders, including the bosses of Tesco, Sainsbury's, Boots and WH Smith, wrote to the government in October, demanding action on rising retail crime, as they said violent criminals were emptying stores. The British newspaper The Financial Times has also covered this story and tells us more. Retailers want the British government to introduce a standalone offence of assaulting, threatening or abusing a retail worker, arguing that this would enable police to understand the scale of the issue and send a message that such crimes are being taken seriously. Under a similar law introduced in Scotland in 2021, retail crimes now carry tougher sentences and require police to record all incidents of retail crime and allow the allocation of more resources. Helen Dickinson, the British Retail Consortium's chief executive, said, "Why should our hard-working colleagues south of the border be offered less protection?" Katie Bourne, the Sussex Police and Crime Commissioner, who is the lead for business crime at the Association of Police and Crime Commissioners, said the levels of retail crime being reported were unprecedented, adding, "Every day, retail staff are facing the consequences of shoplifting, brazen behaviour, and that's why I have supported the call for a specific offence of assault on a shop worker." She added, "Our courts need to work more efficiently and shoplifters need to be deterred from re-offending." The Co-op, which has more than 2,000 stores across the United Kingdom, said it was installing 200 secure till kiosks, locked cabinets for expensive goods and artificial intelligence technology to monitor self-checkouts in its supermarkets after a 44% surge in retail crime last year. It has also doubled the amount it spends on security guards. Last year, the fashion and homeware retailer Nexus boss Simon Wolfson also said he had seen a rise in shoplifting, which had hit profit margins at Next. That came after John Lewis said it suffered a £12 million year-on-year increase in theft, with its chair, Sharon White, calling shoplifting an epidemic. Paul Gerard from the Co-op said the majority of thefts were by people stealing to sell on goods in large volumes and could be accompanied by threats of abuse. Gerard added, people are being followed home from work. I know of one example where we had to move people for their own safety. He said violent theft happened in city centres and leafy market towns, with professional criminals moving on to other stores if extra security measures were put in place at a favoured target. Co-op stores in some areas were reporting more than two incidents a week, where criminals have jumped over till kiosks to steal cigarettes, lottery cards and cash. However, Paul Gerard said there had been green shoots in the past few months as a result of the government's Retail Crime Action Plan published in October, which includes a police commitment to prioritise attending reports of shoplifting involving violence against a shop worker or where security guards have detained an offender. The plan also involves the more controversial Project Pegasus, under which 10 of the country's biggest retailers, including Marks & Spencer, Boots and Primark, are handing CCTV images to police to be run through databases using facial recognition technology in an effort to identify prolific or potentially dangerous individuals. Paul Gerard said police attendance at incidents at co-op stores had shot up to 60% from 20% in October, which was a real step forward. He said, until October, there was no risk in engaging in that type of activity, and now there is a real risk of being arrested and prosecuted. Recently, a coalition of Britain's largest retail associations, including the British Retail Consortium and the Association of Convenience Stores, sent a letter to every police and crime commissioner in England and Wales, decrying a level of shoplifting that they said was having an enormous financial impact on businesses. They said retailers are facing unprecedented levels of shop theft in their stores, with many now seeing organised looting of their businesses on a regular basis. Yet, the Association of Convenience Stores, which represents more than 30,000 local shops, told the Financial Times that shoplifting in its sector had risen to a level it had never seen before. It argued that the discrepancy between the experience of retailers and official statistics was because of a lack of crimes against business, only 16% by its estimation being reported.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
On the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, February 11th, 2019, you should know that if ignorance of the revolution's mottos and negligence of the revolutionary movement had not occurred in some periods during the 40-year history of the revolution, which unfortunately existed and were extremely detrimental, the revolution's accomplishments would have gone far beyond what we witness today and the country would have been far ahead on the path towards the great ideals, and many of the current problems would not have existed today. Today, just like the first days after the revolution, sovereign Iran faces challenges from the imperialist, arrogant powers. Yet, there is a meaningful difference.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If the challenges posed by the United States those days involved ending the intrusion by foreign agents or closing down the embassy of the Zionist regime in Tehran or exposing the spy den, the former U.S. embassy in Tehran. Today, the challenges concern Iran's strong presence near the borders of the Zionist regime, putting an end to the United States' unlawful infiltration in the West Asia, the Islamic Republic's support of the Palestinian people's resistance at the heart of the occupied territories, as well as defending the high-flying flag of Hezbollah and the resistance throughout this region. If, then, the West's concern was to prevent Iran from buying basic weaponry, today their concern is to prevent the transfer of advanced Iranian weapons to the resistance forces. If on those days the United States presumed that the Islamic government and the Iranian nation could be vanquished with the help of a few Iranian sellouts and a small number of aircrafts and helicopters, today they feel they need a coalition of tens of hostile or daunted states to counter Iran on the political and security fronts. And yet, they fail. Thanks to the revolution, Iran today stands out at an elevated position, one that the Iranian nation deserves to enjoy in front of the world. And Iran has already passed the challenging twists on the path of resolving its fundamental issues.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
To think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A report has revealed that U.S. military has been infiltrated by white supremacists and insurrectionists. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story and tells us more. The US military has been infiltrated by white supremacists and insurrectionists, with experts warning a recent Pentagon report detailing dozens of internal plots to overthrow the US government is just the tip of the iceberg. The Department of Defense, the Pentagon, released a report on 30th of November, revealing it has investigated 183 instances of extremism within the U.S. military, including 78 cases of troops advocating for, engaging in, or supporting the overthrow of the U.S. government. But experts have told the Daily Mail that the figures were likely to be a significant underestimate, pointing to a 2020 Military Times poll that showed a third of active service members had witnessed signs of white nationalism or racism among their fellow troops. Historians highlighted a litany of alarming cases in which both current and former U.S. Army members have plotted to assassinate political leaders, bomb media organizations, and topple the U.S. government. Many have never materialized, but those that do often have deadly consequences due to the military training of the perpetrators. Heidi Beirich, co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, charged the Pentagon with not doing enough to root out extremism within its ranks. She told the Daily Mail, "If the military doesn't take this seriously, it means terrorist attacks will be more violent, more successful. This is a poison for the rest of American society. If we don't rip these people out, they're deadly." In a 2019 New York Times report, Carter Smith, who served as an U.S. Army criminal investigator for 30 years before joining the faculty of Middle Tennessee State University, was quoted as saying that the military does not make this issue a priority. Carter Smith said, "They always say the numbers are small, and because of that, it is not a priority. Well, the numbers might be small, but they are like a drop of cyanide in your drink. They can do a lot of damage." The Pentagon report comes amid a series of alarming trends of extremism within the military. Over the past decade, a murderous neo-Nazi group has been founded by a former U.S. soldier. A growing number of plots to attack critical infrastructure in the United States have also hatched by current and former servicemen, while 18% of those charged in connection with the Capitol siege on 6th of January 2021 have military backgrounds. In the wake of the January 6th riots, the Pentagon admitted it did not know how to deal with the problem of extremism within its own ranks and ordered a military-wide pause to allow commanders a window to tackle the issue. Matt Dalek, a political historian at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C., pointed out that radicalization has been a long-standing concern within the U.S. military, the most infamous example being Timothy McVeigh, the former U.S. Army soldier behind the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing that left 168 people dead and injured nearly 700. More recently, a former active-duty U.S. Marine and member of the Army Guard was sentenced to 13 years in prison in 2020, after he was charged with plotting a terrorist massacre of journalists and Democrats, including former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Coast Guard Lieutenant Christopher Hassan was found to have held violent racist views even before he joined the U.S. military, raising questions over vetting procedures. But Matt Dalek, author of Birchers, How the John Birch Society Radicalized the American Right, said, it was hard to tell whether a disproportionate number of servicemen held extremist beliefs due to a lack of data, but warned the issue was particularly concerning due to its potentially fatal fallout. It said, "There is a clear threat in people who are experts in weaponry, who have access to advanced knowledge about how to make bombs, who also have a radical view of the world that impels them to commit violence. That can be a pretty dangerous recipe." Heidi Beirich agreed that attitudes within the military tended to reflect a rise in white nationalism in wider society, but she said there appeared to be a disconnect between the Pentagon's report and the Military Times survey, which she believes indicates a far higher number of military personnel are involved in extremist activities. Heidi Beirich said, "There was a long history of white supremacist groups encouraging their members to join the military so they could learn how to blow things up and be better with weapons, while also spreading their hateful ideologies." The national broadcaster NBC News has also covered the same story. According to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, the growing threat from the far right is attributed to the growth of accelerationism, an ideology that seeks to destabilize society and trigger a race war. Indeed, a report published by the George Washington University in September of last year noted the number of white supremacist plots targeting energy systems had dramatically increased since 2016. Founded by former National Guard soldier who had a picture of fellow veteran and Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh on his dresser, the neo-Nazi group Atomwaffen Division has already been linked to several murders, bombings and plots in the United States and elsewhere. It has also been a part of the growing trend of infrastructure terrorism, in which insurrectionists have targeted critical power stations around the country in a bid to bring an end to the American way of life. According to a criminal complaint filed in Maryland, its founder, Brandon Russell, 28 years old, formerly a private first class in the National Guard, was arrested in February of this year over an alleged racist plot to completely destroy the power grid in the predominantly black city of Baltimore, Maryland. He stands charged with conspiring to inflict maximum harm by shooting at five substations operated by Baltimore Gas and Electric, which serves 1.2 million customers in central Maryland. He met his alleged co-conspirator, Sarah Beth Clendaniel, 27 years old of Maryland, while the pair were in jail. They were caught in an FBI sting operation. In 2018, Russell was sentenced to prison after being convicted of explosives charges. Russell was released from prison in 2021 before his arrest over the Baltimore plot. Clendaniel had been serving a prison sentence for armed robbery when the pair met in prison.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Agreements marking a significant step forward in enhancing economic relations between Iran and Armenia. 19 MOUs that lay down the framework for expanding mutually beneficial bilateral cooperation in a wide range of areas. Iran and Armenia's economic relations have consistently strengthened over the past couple of years, with bilateral trade reaching $1 billion U.S. dollars, and now both sides are ready to take it to the next level.
For both our countries, there is great potential to boost trade, and we are adamant about using all the capacities to expand our relations. I have to note that promoting political and economic relations with Iran has been high on the agenda of the government of Armenia. We attach great importance to our relations with Iran in all fields.
This is all in line.